Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Zoe Russell. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is Guilty Until Proven Innocent, the crime of civil asset forfeiture, with John Payne and Audrey Spaulding of the Show Me Institute. John is a Washington University graduate with a degree in history. He's a former teacher and current research assistant at the Show Me Institute. Audrey is a policy analyst at the Show Me Institute, a graduate of the University of Missouri, and an award-winning journalist. The Show Me Institute hails from St. Louis, Missouri. It's an educational institute dedicated to well-researched, liberty-minded solutions to local policy issues. Both Audrey and John have researched and written about civil asset forfeiture and have presented at the Mises Institute's Austrian Scholars Conference. So this is kind of a different topic, not necessarily well publicized, certainly hair-raising if you happen to find yourself in the middle of it. John, can you tell us what is civil asset forfeiture?
Sure. Civil asset forfeiture is essentially, it's a legal process that allows the government to take property away from accused criminals. Now, the big difference here between civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture is that under civil forfeiture, they actually sue the property itself. So you'll see cases where it'll say U.S. government or, you know, state of Missouri versus 1972 El Dorado or versus $5,000 in cash. So that's what is known as an in rem proceeding. And since they're not actually taking a person to trial, they're taking a piece of property to trial, that property does not have all the same rights that a person does. So a lot of the due process standards that we think of for trial don't exist in these cases.
So is that what you mean by a preponderance of the evidence? You're not necessarily innocent until proven guilty. It's just a preponderance of the evidence to be able to forfeit or maintain the forfeiture over your property.
Yeah, that is one of the lower standards for civil asset forfeiture rather than for criminal law. So if you go to court and you're tried for a crime, you would have to be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard in a criminal case. But in a civil asset forfeiture case, you would just have to have a preponderance of the evidence. So just, it's more likely than not that your property was used in a crime, and then they can take your property away from you. And so that's, we would find that unacceptable in a criminal proceeding, but we allow that under these civil proceedings where people can lose their property.
So how did the whole asset forfeiture thing come about in the very first place?
Well, a long, long time ago, it was people believed that property that was used in crimes was became, by being used in that crime, evil itself, and so someone had to take it and destroy it or use it for a good purpose, and that would sort of remove the curse from that property. But in America, the main use of it started to come about during the product of the drug war in the 1970s. The big change, however, what really made civil asset forfeiture take off was in 1984 when the government passed the Comprehensive Crime Control Act, and that allowed law enforcement agencies to keep up to 80% of forfeiture proceeds, and that's what is known as equitable sharing. So if a policing agency a local policing agency went out and seized someone's car I've seen cases like this, for a DWI, because the car was used in a crime, then that car could then be sold and the federal government could get the get 20% of the money, and the state government would, and the state law enforcement agency would keep 80% of the funds. So it's a direct incentive for them to go out and forfeit property.
I see. So have we always in this country had criminal asset forfeiture?
Yes. If you're involved with a crime and they convict you of a crime, then you can have any property you had forfeit, possibly for recompensation or for if it was involved with a crime, to be sold off by the police. A lot of that's existed forever in this country.
Okay, let me cut you off there. We're about to go for our first break, but we'll be back with a much longer segment. Hello and welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Zoe Russell here with Show Me Institute researchers Audrey Spaulding and John Payne. I'm filling in for Michael McKay, Radio Free Market founder. We were just discussing the difference between civil and criminal asset forfeiture. So I want to know what exactly today is the justification for seizing people's property. It's not really used as evidence in the crime, correct?
It's possible that it could be, but those forfeitures can be justified as part of criminal forfeiture. These civil forfeiture is typically that they're trying to raise money for law enforcement. That is typically the justification for it. One of the ideas is that it would take the money out of, you know, they wouldn't let crime pay, so that if you took money away from criminals, that it would, you know, be another disincentive for committing crimes. But the problem, you know, that's all well and good, but the problem is that a lot of times innocent people who get convicted of no crime have their property taken away from them under these laws.
Right. I mean, I don't necessarily think that it makes a whole lot of sense to take the property away even if they're guilty, but I guess the point being that they can't go back when they get out of jail and come back to their assets. But y'all are specifically researching the civil cases. So let's talk more about the drug. I think it was about the drug war specifically that prompted these types of laws to come about.
Well, I think one of the reasons was that there was a feeling that people weren't able to necessarily convict someone of a crime, but maybe they could take his property and then sell it and reap benefits from it. And so that, I think that was part of the idea originally, that part of what made it attractive to lawmakers, but you know that has some negative consequences for everybody because it makes all of our property rights less secure.
Mm-hmm. So now we're in 1984, and the Comprehensive Crime Act has come about, and asset forfeiture is really taking off. So what are the parameters around what local police and federal agents are allowed to confiscate? Like, let's say that a piece of property has become a crime scene. Some, you know, even innocent person's home, can the police just do a quick scan of the household and generally remove everything inside as well as the house itself?
Yes. you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the scene of a crime scene per se. You know, when we were reviewing some of the forfeitures here in Missouri, things like Xboxes could be seized under civil asset forfeiture. So, you know, it does depend somewhat on the state, but in general, if the police can somehow suspect that you got your property through drug use or drug sales, then they can take it.
Or any sort of criminal activity. If there's a reasonable suspicion that is how you obtained the property or that the property was involved in a crime in some way, then they can take that property under asset forfeiture, and you as an individual will have to sue to get it back. The trial will not happen unless you instigate it.
So there's no, like, necessarily specific crime that's laid out. It can be for any type of crime where they think that's how you purchased said good.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay. So what does the government have to prove in order to take it? Do they have to necessarily prove anything, or can they just sort of come in and confiscate the property?
To seize it initially, all they need is a reasonable suspicion. And so that's pretty broad power there. Now, if you then fight it and go to court over it, they're going to have to prove it with a preponderance of the evidence, which is, you know, more likely than not. And that's, you know, that's something that's not terrible. I think it should be the higher reasonable doubt standard, but nonetheless, a big problem is that just by seizing it initially, a person is going to have to go through all this trouble, hire a lawyer, pay for these legal fees to get it back, and, you know, because they have such wide power to seize it in the first place. And this creates a lot of problems for people who may have no criminal activity whatsoever. And so, you know, this is something that we should probably look into stopping.
Right. And you really have to look at how a law enforcement officer or agency can get around some of the safeguards that we would think would help protect you. So, for example, you know, as John pointed out, they can seize the property. Well, here in Missouri, we've seen some law enforcement entities assume that they have to charge you with a crime within a few days after seizing your property. But other areas of the state will wait, you know, half a year to a year or more before charging you with a crime. So if you think about it, your property is really in limbo. It's been seized, but you haven't been charged with a crime. You know, I think, and again, it's really important to think about, like, what other ways a law enforcement officer, what kind of latitude he or she might have to kind of effectively circumvent the law.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to walk through it. Let's just say a crime is committed, you know, your property's seized, you wait around until a criminal charge is filed, which could be however long, you know, the enforcement agency takes. Then you go to court, you're found guilty, and you never get your stuff back. So is that correct in the criminal case?
That's one way that it could happen. You know, although even if you're found guilty of the crime, you may not be, you could still potentially win the civil case and get your property back. It's possible. We've seen cases where that's happened. But there's also cases where a person is convicted of no crime, but the civil case sticks and they lose their property. And so that's, you know, that seems odd that our justice system would find a person not guilty in a criminal context, but then be able to take their property anyway. So that's a problem. So these are actually two separate trials. And sometimes there's not even a criminal charge ever brought against the person. There's only a civil charge against the property.
What's really important to remember is that, you know, some states might have a stricter law to kind of help protect property owners, but the federal government still has its own asset forfeiture laws. So what we can see in Missouri, for example, which requires that you have to be convicted of a felony in order for your property to be seized, is if that criminal case never materializes, you just see that the forfeiture case where they try to take your property, that goes federal because there's not the same burden on the federal government.
Mm-hmm. So do y'all have any idea what they do with the property while it's sort of sitting around in their coffers?
That actually is a good question. We're not entirely sure, and it varies. It's going to vary from department to department, from police agency to police agency. One of the interesting stories that we found was that in St. Louis City, they had been using civil asset forfeiture laws to seize a lot of vehicles. And these vehicles, in hundreds upon hundreds of vehicles every year, more than the rest of the state combined, actually, in terms of the number of vehicles. And what the city was doing with these is that it was taking them to a towing it was having a towing private towing company tow these vehicles, and then it would call people and tell them that they had to come get their car out of impound and charge them exorbitant amounts of money to get the car out of impound. And then the towing company, if they did not show up within a month to pay off all the impound fees, the vehicle then became property of the towing company, who in some cases sold cars to, for instance, the chief of police, police's daughter, for very, very low prices. So it was a big scandal. And when the St. Louis Post-Dispatch started reporting on this, incidentally, the number of forfeitures of vehicles in the city went down to zero within a few months. So it was a radical turnaround. But that's one instance where we actually know what they were doing with the property, and it was pretty corrupt, it seems like, but in other cases, we just don't know.
Right, exactly. So until somebody breaks the next story, then we're kind of left guessing as to what they're doing.
And that's really the pattern we see everywhere, you know, in terms of whenever it comes to reforms to asset forfeiture laws, it seems to be that it takes some big news agency or some research organization to uncover a whole lot of material about how the laws are being circumvented in some way. And then there's change, which is really kind of upsetting because you would think that some of the government agencies that should be monitoring this, such as state auditors, would have caught this kind of stuff, but they don't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Have you all gotten a lot of really great feedback for your work?
Well, so far we haven't actually published the full story yet, but we've talked about it with several different groups and different people, and the feedback has been pretty positive so far. So yeah, we're pretty much done with the draft, and we're sending it off for viewers to look at here shortly. So we're hoping that they have the same opinions that of the work as everyone else has so far.
So do y'all think that? I think this is pretty intuitive that police sort of pick on the average Joe, small guy that's not going to really fight back because they make it so difficult to get the property back.
Yeah. I mean, I think the towing truck scandal in St. Louis is a perfect example. You know, it's incredible that 1,000 cars were forfeited or seized in a single year, and there was no news about it, you know, and then they were seized again the next year, and there was no news about it, and it took a number of years. And a totally different issue, which was that the police chief's daughter crashed one of the cars that had been seized through this process, for the newspaper to even start looking into it. The people whose cars were being seized just kind of, you know, went along with, well, I guess I do have to pay a few thousand dollars to get my car back, and they didn't really complain. And I think that's part of the reason that the police department and the towing company thought that, well, this was such a good money-making idea. You know, I think it really strikes home to think that if you're carrying $300, say, in your pocket because you're going on vacation or something, that it's, you know, if you were stopped and that money were seen on your person, there is a chance that it could be taken from you with no evidence of a crime.
Yeah, and there's one of the worst abuses of civil asset forfeiture happened in a place called Tinaha, Texas, which is this little town in East Texas, and the police there were essentially stopping motorists who were traveling through the town. Almost none of these people were residents of Tinaha, but overwhelmingly black and Latino, and they
Hold on one moment there. Let me cut you off, and we'll come right back to that story after this quick break. Hi, and welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm here with Audrey Spaulding and John Payne of the Show Me Institute. We're talking about civil asset forfeiture and basically guilty until proven innocent. So we were just talking about a small East Texas town that's pretty notorious for this type of stuff. John, can you keep telling your story about Tinaha?
Yeah, sure. So in Tinaha, they were mostly pulling over motorists who were traveling through the town. Most of these people were black or Hispanic, and the police were essentially shaking them down for their money or their property. One gentleman, Roderick Daniels, he was pulled over for driving 37 miles per hour in a 35 zone, and then the police discovered that he was traveling with about $8,500 in cash on him. Daniels claimed that this was to purchase a car, and the police had no evidence that, you know, he was traveling with drugs or, you know, that he had committed any sort of crime, but they took the money as being evidence automatically of him being involved in some sort of criminal activity. And so they took him into custody and threatened him with a money laundering charge, a criminal charge, if he didn't sign a waiver giving the money, saying, I have no claim to this money, therefore the Tinaha Police Department can have it. Now, this is back to Daniels after it was uncovered that he was just one among many who this had happened to, and criminal charges were never filed. They never had any evidence that these people were guilty of any crimes, but they would take the money. And now, one thing that's most disturbing about this is this doesn't even necessarily qualify as civil forfeiture. This is what we would call forfeiture through abandonment. And because when Daniels renounced his claim to the money, the police don't have to fill out any paperwork calling it civil asset forfeiture. The extent of this problem is largely unknown. At least in Missouri, the policing agencies don't have to report on it. We have some anecdotal evidence that it may be going on up here, but we don't have any firm way of establishing how often. And so this is the extent of this problem is very hard to establish, and it's pretty troublesome.
Yeah, sounds pretty troublesome. So I read also, and this town was actually pretty well reported because I knew of it before I'd heard about the two of your research, that they were threatening them with I'm going to take your children away and hand them over to Child Protection Services, and just immense amounts of people. I had a statistic here, seized property from 140 motorists over 3 years and filed criminal charges against fewer than half. And then they brought a civil action lawsuit, all of them together, and that's the only reason that they sort of got any media play.
Well, I have to say, you know, Tenahaw, Texas is a really bad example, but the statistic you just cited about taking property and only filing criminal charges in about half is what we're seeing here in Missouri. And that's the stuff that's reported. That's not this administrative, that's not this abandonment forfeiture.
Right.
Right. That's just they seized property from you. They said it was civil forfeiture, and yet still, even though Missouri requires them to file a criminal charge, still fewer than half have no criminal charges at all. And so that really raises the question, again, you know, oh, well, sure, we're going to file a criminal charge in the future. Well, it's like, well, how long do we have to wait for that? You know, I think certainly one solution would be to say, well, if you don't file a criminal charge in 6 months or, you know, 3 months, then you need to provide an answer as to why. You better explain yourself, because at this point, it certainly doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So how did y'all come upon this research topic in the first place?
Of course, I occasionally go to public meetings, and I went to the St. Charles County Council budget planning meeting, which
St. Charles, for any listeners who are not familiar with St. Louis geography, is a fairly well-to-do suburb of St. Louis off to the northwest. So.
Right, and they actually do a lot of asset forfeiture, unbeknownst to me. I was there for something completely unrelated, but while I was there, they were discussing what to do with the more than $1 million they had collected in asset forfeiture money. And federal asset forfeiture money is not supposed to go to funding ongoing operations, so things like salaries and supplies that you use up frequently, because there's the intent of, you know, not having police agencies get addicted to asset forfeiture.
Right.
The idea being, you know, you can use this money for bigger purchases, maybe a building or a car or something, but we don't want you to fund all of your salaries with it. So what St. Charles County Council was saying was, well, we have all this money. What do we do with it? And lo and behold, they wanted to spend it on salary increases for their sheriffs and for their other law enforcement officers. But they couldn't do that because of the federal restrictions. So what they did is they said, okay, we will take money out of our budget for the purchase of cars, and we will use that money to pay for the increase in salaries, and then we will take this federal money and replace the funds we just took out from funding cars. And so that immediately, yeah, like, oh, you know, and I mean, if St. Charles County can do it, anyone can do it, you know, like, it's not that hard, it's not rocket science. But that immediately made me kind of like talk to John and say, well, gosh, maybe we should look at this, you know, because this was just so blatant. And one of the reasons is that, you know, these budgetary planning meetings are extremely boring. Nobody goes to them, and so it's perfectly fine for them to just sit there and describe things that, you know, really fly in the face of federal law, but do them anyway.
Basically, Enron accounting, right in public view.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is incredible what people will say at even local city meetings. Well, we're about to head into a break, and we'll come back with our long segment. Our topic is civil asset forfeiture, so stay with us. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. Our topic is Guilty Until Proven Innocent, the Crime of Civil Asset Forfeiture. Audrey was just telling us about the budget meeting she'd attended that got her interested in civil asset forfeiture within Missouri. So I want to know, how is asset forfeiture handled differently at the state level versus the federal level? Do many states have their own asset forfeiture laws on top of federal laws?
Absolutely. You know, and every state law is different. I will say that Missouri is one of only 8 states that don't allow their law enforcement agencies to keep any of the civil asset forfeiture proceeds. So what that means is, as a law enforcement agency, when you're going to forfeit property, generally you can opt between the state law and the federal law, if the federal government will accept your forfeiture and accept taking it over. So if you know that you're not going to get any money back if you go through the state forfeiture, then you're probably going to go through the federal forfeiture. We've seen that already here in Missouri. As the recession has gone on, we've seen the amount of money that law enforcement agencies in Missouri get from the federal government just skyrocket, which, you know, really, there's no corresponding increase in state forfeiture, so it's probably doesn't have anything to do with a huge increase in crime. It probably has more to do with budgets. So different states have different policies. The other thing that I think is important to mention, if I can remember the exact, the other thing important to mention is not only do most states allow their law enforcement agencies to keep some of the funds, a majority, 27, allow law enforcement agencies to keep all of the funds. So then what you really have is you have an incentive at both the federal level and the state level to forfeit away because it's going to help your bottom line.
I see. So is Missouri doing a lot better than its neighbors in terms of how much property they seize, or are they still seizing about the same amount, they just do it in a creative way?
It's the second. They do it in a creative way. Actually, we compared the amount of money Missouri gets per resident through federal forfeiture to the surrounding states, and Missouri gets more than any surrounding state with the exception of Nebraska. Nebraska is basically the same amount. It's just a different of a dime or two per resident. I think Missouri gets about $3 per capita every year from federal forfeiture, which if you think about it, we have 6 million people, so we're getting a lot from federal forfeiture. And meanwhile, you know, our state forfeiture numbers have kind of remained roughly constant. So we're increasing it our federal forfeitures, again, presumably because of budgetary pressure.
Now, it's also important to mention that, you know, at the state level, all the money is supposed to, in Missouri, if you go through state level forfeiture, all the money is supposed to go into a fund for school construction. And so, you know, a lot of people view this as taking money away from schools. You know, I'm not sure if that's the best prism to view it through, but nonetheless, you know, it's at least a place where if it was going there, the law enforcement agency wouldn't have the incentive to go out and seek out people's property and take it from them on, you know, little to no evidence.
Right, and I read that, I read from y'all that the school building revolving fund gets all the assets since a 1990 Missouri Supreme Court ruling. So were Missouri law enforcement agencies able to practice asset forfeiture pretty much however they please before the 1990 ruling?
Well, before the 1990 ruling, it seemed like there were these two portions of state law that were conflicting. It seemed like under state law, you could choose whether you wanted the law enforcement agency to keep the proceeds or if you wanted it to go to the school building revolving fund. So then the issue went to the Supreme Court because the school districts really wanted the money, and the Supreme Court said, you know what, it needs to go to the schools. It's not supposed to be going to the law enforcement agencies. And what was interesting is after that ruling, you know, the heads of law enforcement agencies, you know, chiefs of police were saying very publicly, this means we're going to go the federal route.
So also, how did the laws in Missouri change in 1993?
Oh, yeah. So in 1993, the Missouri enacted forfeiture reform laws to forbid a forfeiture occurring unless a corresponding felony charge had been filed. Prior to that, there had been a series of articles in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch illustrating that forfeiture money was being taken when there really was no criminal charge. It was just kind of, you know, well, we really want this property, and it looks like it could have been part of the commission of a crime, so we're going to take it. Now, again, under Missouri law, the statute says that the property cannot be forfeited unless the individual, the owner, has been charged subsequently with a Class C felony or greater. Now, again, as we discussed previously, the word subsequently, at least to you and me, seems like, well, you better file that criminal charge pretty quickly thereafter. But in practice, a lot of law enforcement a lot of law enforcement agencies seem to be very confused as to the meaning of subsequently. I think we've seen counties where that can mean 100 days or more. I think that's certainly an area for improvement.
Also, right. There are some cases where, although there's been a criminal charge, a felony-level criminal charge filed against somebody, Missouri law requires that if the forfeiture is to actually stand, there has to be a conviction as well. It can't just be charged. But we have seen cases where, a charge starts out as they charge a person with a felony-level charge, but then it's either plea bargained down or the person's found not guilty, yet the civil forfeiture case goes forward, and in one instance, a guy had money taken from him, and he went to court over it and got the money back, but he had to pay a lawyer and pay all these fees in order to do that. When that forfeiture, because the criminal charge was plea bargained, the forfeiture never should have happened in the first place. So the government in that case was obviously violating the law, but even the guy's attorney wasn't aware of it.
I see. Meanwhile, just as Missouri is having all these issues with asset forfeiture, there's a drive for reform in D.C. as well. So what exactly led to CAFRA? Was there a federal, outrageous kind of federal forfeiture that led to CAFRA in 2000?
Well, there was I don't know if there was one big event that sort of crystallized the opposition to it, but there were it was an issue that a lot of conservative Republicans like Henry Hyde and Bob Barr, who were in Congress at the time, as well as some Democrats could work together on, because it both illustrated the excesses of the drug war and the need for greater property rights. So there was some bipartisanship in crafting the legislation. And so in 2000, Henry Hyde was the one who really spearheaded it. And what it did is it actually raised the standard of evidence that the government had to meet in civil forfeiture cases to a preponderance of evidence. Before that, it wasn't even that. It was basically that there was reasonable suspicion and they could take it, and you would have to sue and prove that you didn't do it. You'd have to prove a negative, essentially, in order to get your property back. And also, it provided for an innocent owner defense, which is, say there's an old grandmother and her grandson lives in her house, and unbeknownst to her, her grandson is selling marijuana out of the house. Well, the police could come in and seize the house because it was used in a crime. Well, under Henry Hyde's reforms and CAFRA, you cannot seize the house. The house would still be hers because she was unaware of it. She's innocent, so the property can't be seized. And it also provided for a public defender for poor property owners, especially in cases where their homes are being seized. So these were some good improvements, but there were some things that it did not improve. Mainly that it left equitable sharing in place, so it's still the incentive to go out and seek out forfeitures is still there, and so that's the biggest thing that's driving these numbers. And even though these forfeiture changes happened, the equitable sharing was still driving a large increase in federal forfeiture. So you have forfeitures going from a few hundred million dollars a year up to about $1.5 billion a year by 2008. And the other thing that it did not do anything about was the forfeiture waivers, the sort of thing you saw in Tinaha, Texas, where the police say, we're going to take your property unless you sign over the right to your property to us. That way we won't charge you with any sort of criminal wrongdoing. And so that is still legal under CAFRA, and that's one of the things that really needs to be changed.
Right. So just basically extortion, in other words.
In many cases, yes.
Yeah. So like you said, it's gone from $338 million in 1996, I'm reading your notes, to $1.3 billion in 2008. And then y'all said it's gone up since then with this recession. I mean, I'm not surprised by that at all with government budgets tightening across the country. It's sort of enforcement agencies are going into their revenue-seeking mode. So around here, you see a lot more police on the streets writing tickets. So y'all are tracking, you know, where's your focus nowadays in Missouri in terms of tracking this? What are your, what are you looking into going forward with this kind of, with this topic, research topic?
Well, I do think it's really important to call attention to the fact that in Missouri and probably everywhere else, federal forfeitures are increasing. In Missouri, it's gone from a little more than $10 million to almost $20 million between 2008 and 2009, which is incredible. Basically, it's nearly doubled. I also think it's important to continue to call attention, and though there might not be an easy answer, to the fact that these federal laws and different state laws are conflicting, and that basically the federal law allows government agencies to override a lot of state laws, to bypass them. I think that's really important, you know, that there are these states that are trying to provide greater property rights and security to state residents, and yet law enforcement agencies can say, you know what, we don't like that law. We're just going to take this to the federal level.
Also, I think moving forward, we would, you know, it's not entirely positive that we'll be able to do more on this subject, but if we are able to, I think some of the things we'd like to look into is the extent of administrative or abandonment forfeiture. So to what extent are police agencies in Missouri using these forfeiture waivers to take people's property? And also, you know, getting the auditor to keep better records, you know, forcing the counties to keep better records of all the ways they do forfeiture and reporting that to the auditor. So at least, you know, whether it be us or some other interested organization or individual in the public can go out and get this information and report on what the police are doing, because it's not, you know, if it's not all kept, if all that information is not kept, we really don't know. And that's one of the most troubling things about it, is that there's so much that we don't know. And we already see how much what we do know about is abused. And that's where the police have some incentive not to be, you know, too crazy with it, because they know people might find out about it. So how much worse might it be in cases where they know that they're never going to be subject to, you know, public attention?
Right. So what are the counties that are doing it correctly in?
Well, I would say one of the standout counties is Boone County, which actually is the county encompassing Columbia, Missouri, which is in the center of the state and also has the campus of the University of Missouri. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but Boone County does a very good job. Boone County is the county that interpreted the Missouri state statute that says a criminal charge must be filed subsequently to the seizure of property extremely strictly, to the point in some cases of actually filing the criminal charge first. I believe the average delay between a seizure and the filing of a criminal charge in Boone County is 4 days or less. I mean, it's just incredible there. They do a really great job. Now, by contrast, you know, we have counties like Greene County, which are also have a lot of people, but certainly don't seem that concerned about getting their criminal charges in place in any sort of timely manner, and as well as Cole County, which actually is just south of Boone County. So really, in Missouri, just being stopped by a police officer on one side or the other of a county line can really make all the difference in the world in terms of how you're treated and how your property rights are respected.
So is this where you drew your ideas for better methods of reform in Missouri from, you know, comparing different counties and how they interpret the rules differently?
Yeah, absolutely. Though, again, I would say across the board, I mean, you know, a lot of these counties are doing federal forfeiture, and a lot of them do it pretty frequently. I think like four counties in Missouri all forfeited more than $1 million in 2009 alone, using the federal forfeiture laws. So that still is kind of an indication that this is a problem across the state of Missouri. You know, there are some counties that play by the rules in many cases, but overall there are some concerns that we have throughout the state.
I'd say the big variation between counties is the length of time that the forfeitures are held without any criminal charges. Audrey was talking about Boone County being very good on that with only a few days. Well, Franklin County, which is sort of on the exurbs of St. Louis, it's a very outer county, their average delay between when they file a criminal charge and when they file the civil charge against the property is 342 days. So that's almost a year, and that's a huge gap from the 4.2 days that you're looking at in Boone County. But the thing is that, like Audrey said, there's problems in every one of these counties because a lot of these counties are still pursuing forfeiture in cases where there is no criminal charge through the federal government, and people are forfeiting property without ever being convicted of a crime, and that's something that should probably stop.
And can we just talk really briefly about records maintenance? I mean, we're in the year 2011, we're in the 21st century, well into it, and we're still seeing policing agencies, which we know have the technology to do better, submitting their records of their forfeitures, you know, the report that they have to submit to the state that says this is how much we forfeited and this is who we forfeited it from. They're submitting
on
that.
A napkin. Probably
huh?
On a napkin, even on a
yeah.
napkin. With
yeah, like it's just handwritten, you know, and that's incredible to me because I can tell you right now, I'm sure that they do have it in a spreadsheet somewhere. Like what is the reason that we are handwriting in this information other than it makes it really hard for people like John and me to put together a report because we have to go and type it all in. And things like that can really serve as a barrier to any other watchdog groups.
Right. So what are your ideas? We're about to head into a break, but we'll go further into this in the next segment. But what are your ideas for better methods of reform in Missouri?
Well, I think one of the key things is that localities need to offset the amount of money that their policing agencies get from federal asset forfeiture and just deny them that amount of money in their budgets. Say, if you want to pursue federal forfeiture, that's fine, but we're not going to allow you to profit from it. So if you get $1 million in federal forfeiture money, we're going to take $1 million out of your budget next year. And that, you know, I think that's politically possible as well because it appeals to all these city councils that would like to save money.
Right. All right, well, we're going to head into our next closing segment here in just a second. We'll come back with Audrey Spaulding and John Payne of the Show Me Institute, who were so gracious to help us out learning about civil asset forfeiture. Welcome back to our last segment of Guilty Until Proven Innocent, the Crime of Civil Asset Forfeiture with John Payne and Audrey Spaulding of the Show Me Institute. So y'all were just talking about a method of reform that y'all would put in place in Missouri specifically, that localities should offset the money gained from federal forfeiture dollar for dollar. Do you have any other ones?
Well, I think the other thing that, you know, we've been talking about is the fact that sometimes property is seized and then it takes, you know, it can take up to a year or more for you to ultimately end up with a criminal charge. Now, we think that that needs to be addressed. You know, it could be addressed by compensating someone whose property has been held for more than a year just, you know, to discourage law enforcement agencies from that practice. Or it could also be requiring law enforcement agencies to explain in writing why they still haven't produced a criminal charge against you even though they've been holding your property for a bunch of months. And that would kind of open the door perhaps to some litigation to say, well, you need to give this back to me, or just to produce it to a judge and say, well, look, clearly the law isn't being followed in this case. I need my property back.
Sort of consider it sort of like a writ of habeas corpus for your property instead of produce the body. You know, a writ of habeas corpus requires that if you're going to hold someone in jail, you have to bring charges against that person and give them a trial. Well, in this case, if you're going to hold this property, then you need to bring charges against this person, or, you know, you need to give us an explanation for why the seizure is, you know, acceptable within the law. So it would be sort of like that, except just in the case of property.
Right. I just want to read a quote that I found off the Federal Department of Justice's asset forfeiture program website, and they say that their asset forfeiture program encompasses the seizure and forfeiture of assets that represent the proceeds of or where employ asset forfeiture powers in a manner that enhances public safety and security. This is accomplished by removing the proceeds of crime and other assets relied upon by criminals and their associates to perpetuate their crime activity against our society. So would y'all say that this is the most common way that you see asset forfeiture used, or are the incentives just entirely all wrong and it goes into the coffers of local government?
Well, I'll say that, you know, there are plenty of cases that I see where the person is convicted of a crime and is, you know, does not seem like a good guy. I'm not going to say that everyone who has civil asset forfeiture used against them is a victim. But I do see plenty of cases where either no charges are ever filed or the person is found not guilty. And in, you know, in the American criminal justice system, at least ideally, we're not supposed to punish people unless they're found guilty of a crime. And so I would say that in those cases, we're punishing people without ever, you know, seeking a conviction against them, and that's fundamentally unjust. And also, you know, at the at another level, we're just able to inconvenience a lot of people who, you know, they aren't able to get their property back because they, you know, it's taken from them, and it's maybe a couple hundred dollars. Well, you could go out and get a lawyer and fight it, but that's probably going to cost you more than it's worth. And so in those cases, who knows if there was ever a crime committed, but the police are more interested in the money, and so it seems like it's perverting the incentives of law enforcement.
And I think, you know, the other thing, and I'm sure you could address this or have addressed this in many other radio programs, but, you know, okay, so the language used on the DEA's website, you know, is that we need these laws to deprive drug criminals of their property and their resources, and that's why we do it. You know, we had a case in Missouri, Camp Zoe, where, you know, there were people using drugs on the property, but they were not the owner. And the law enforcement agencies knew about this, and they didn't arrest the people as they were actually doing this currently criminal behavior. But they waited for a while so that they could seize the property. So if the ostensible purpose is to crack down on drug crime, then that certainly wasn't what was going on there. It was more,
right.
You know, mm-hmm. Well, it looks like some good property. We want it.
Mm-hmm. Let me cut y'all off there, and I want to thank y'all so much for being on the show with us today. I really appreciate your time. This is Zoe Russell signing off with Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web where you can find this and all of our shows for free. Wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.